to Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Her name was Sarah Emma Edmondson. She was born in Canada, but in 1861 she passed herself off as a man, joined the Union Army, and became Private Thompson. Hers is a fascinating story of defying social conventions and more, and our guest this week, Laura Lee DeGansler, has told that story in her book, The Mysterious Private Thompson. Talking History's Lena Place will be speaking with Gansler in a moment. Following that, Fiona Beatty will tell us where on the web we can find out more about the role women played in the American Civil War, and Harvey Kay will join us to provide some historical background for an item very much in the news, namely the government's failure to respond promptly to the disaster wreaked by Hurricane Katrina on the Gulf Coast. Kay has titled his commentary, "These Are the Times, the Words of Thomas Paine." But first, let's look at some items of historical interest in the news. Historians have long puzzled over whether Abraham Lincoln might have had a genetic disorder called Marfan syndrome. But new research, which appeared at the end of January in the online edition of the journal Nature Genetics, suggests that another disorder caused his clumsy gait. Researchers at the University of Minnesota have discovered a gene mutation in 11 generations of relatives who descended from Lincoln's grandparents. The gene causes a degenerative neurological disorder that affects coordination, including walking, writing, speaking, and swallowing. There's a 25% chance that Lincoln inherited the mutation, but researchers cannot be any more certain because Lincoln has no living direct descendants. Confirming whether the nation's 16th president had the defective gene would require that his DNA be taken and tested, and so far, that idea has been rejected. Researchers have found the earliest remains yet of African slaves in the Western Hemisphere in a 16th century Mexican graveyard. The discovery, dating to the late 1500s, confirms historical accounts that slavery began in the New World not long after Europeans conquered Mexico, the February issue of the American Journal of Physical Anthropology reports. The graves were discovered near the ruins of a colonial church in Campeche, Mexico, a port city on the Yucatan Peninsula. And in another burial discovery, according to a story in the Boston Globe, workers setting out to dig a manhole on a city street in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, struck the remains of about 200 coffins, which turned out to be a long-forgotten graveyard for the city's African slaves. Slaves were used in Portsmouth as rope makers, shipwrights, potters, and cooks. Some were owned by the city's founder, William Whipple, a Revolutionary War commander, who has a street and school named for him. The remains of the buried slaves have been locked in a public works building while the city prepares a new ground for their reburial, a proper funeral, and a memorial. Several black residents have submitted DNA samples to determine if the bodies are of their ancestors. When we return, Lena Place talks with Laura Lee DeGansler about the mysterious Private Thompson. This is Talking History.
Mentalist is fit that wives should submit to their husbands submissively, weakly. Though whatever they say, their wives should obey, unquestioning, stupidly, meekly. Our husbands would make us their own dictum take, without ever a wherefore or why for it. But I don't and I can't, and I won't and I shan't, no, I will speak my mind if I die for it.
In 1861, Sarah Edmondson joined the Army and fought for the Union. Why did she ever do that? How did she pass her physical? And why didn't her fellow soldiers discover her secret? Talking History's Lena Place asks these and other questions of Edmondson's biographer, Laura Lee DeGansler.
Soldier, nurse, spy. Private Frank Thompson, an enlisted Union soldier in the Civil War, was all of those. But Private Thompson was something else as well. He was a woman, passing as a man. Our guest today, Laura Lee DeGansler, has recounted the story in her recent book, The Mysterious Private Thompson, The Double Life of Sarah Emma Edmonds, Civil War Soldier. Laura Gansler is a writer and lawyer who lives in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you.
It's a riveting account. You begin with the birth of Sarah Emma, who was known as Emma, right, in 1841 in what was apparently a pretty bleak Canadian farm. Can you tell us a little bit about her early life and then some of the factors that motivated her to leave that farm and adopt the guise of a man?
Well, it was a pretty bleak place to grow up. It was very remote and cold and isolated. And she was born into a family of four girls and one boy ahead of her. And her father was very much hoping that she would be a boy. Her brother was not healthy, and he really wanted a healthy son. When she turned out to be a girl, her father really was disappointed. And she, according to her diary and her letters, that really clouded her entire childhood, that her mm-hmm. father really never treated her well. And then he was also very abusive to her mother. And because of that, she grew up with the idea that marriage as an institution was not something that she was interested in. And that was one of the reasons when she turned 17 that she decided that she needed to escape, because her father had arranged a marriage for her to an older neighbor. And she desperately wanted to avoid that fate. She'd seen some of her older sisters get married and head down that path. But the only way that she could come up with to really successfully run away without being recognized was to adopt the persona of a young man. So she managed to cut off her hair and get a suit of boy's clothing, and she went off into the world to escape that, what she'd seen her mother and her sisters, the lives that they had had.
And her mother actually helped her, right?
Her mother did help her, yes. There's a little bit of cloudiness about exactly how she managed to escape. But the most reliable account that we have is that her mother actually enlisted the help of one of her mother's friends who lived in a nearby town to help her, take her into town and help her get her on her way, because her mother also didn't want her youngest daughter to suffer the kind of experiences she was having in her marriage.
Mm-hmm. Well, during that growing up and really throughout her life, as you make clear, she was an avid reader, especially of the romantic pulp fiction that was popular in the day. One of the best titles, what, Fanny Campbell, the female pirate captain, seems to have had an enormous impact on her. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It did. When she was about 13 years old, a peddler came through her village and stayed with her family for the night and left a book with them that was this book about a female pirate who had escaped and adopted a male identity and gone off into the world and ultimately rescued her lover. And it was a very exciting, adventurous story. But Emma really took it to heart. And I think that she, for the rest of her life, gave that book the credit for planting the idea in her head that it was possible to do that, even though the book was fiction. And she knew, according to Emma's own diaries, that that was what planted the idea, and she was just waiting for her chance to emulate Fanny Campbell. And in fact, she did.
And yet that young woman who was the reader of pulp fiction was also, again, throughout her life, deeply religious. How did those two influences work together, the romantic and the religious, to motivate her?
That's an interesting question. She was very profoundly religious, and I think it was not just a matter of lip service, because the people that knew her throughout her life, who served with her, who knew her in her later years, all attested to her deep, devout faith. And her works later in life were about helping people. And yet she was profoundly cynical about the church as an institution, which was fairly unusual for someone at that time, particularly someone who grew up with a very religious mother and didn't have a lot of exposure to other things growing up, that she had a real suspicion of the church as an institution. And in fact, in later life, although she was very religious, she never attended church.
Oh, really? Okay.
She stopped going after the war, and she attended services during the war, but after the war, she didn't. And part of that may be attributed to the fact that during the war, she saw some actions on the part of clergymen that she thought were less than noble, and it seemed to have soured her view of the church as an institution. But her faith seemed to be undiminished throughout her life. She seemed to have an idea that God had a will for her, had a plan for her. And she, you know, whether it was self-serving or not on her part, she definitely viewed that what she was doing was the best way she could fulfill what she saw as God's calling to her to help others.
So, disguised as a man, she departed for the cities of Eastern Canada, got safely away from her family, and particularly her father. Why do you think she continued to assume the guise of a man and apparently became a very successful bookseller working up and down the coast?
She did, and I think she liked it. Her first intention was simply to get away, far enough away. But why she didn't then go back to her female identity, I think is pretty much attributable to the fact that life was a little more inviting to a single young man back then than to a single young woman. She had much more independence as a young man. She found she was able to travel freely. She was able to work. She was able to earn money. She didn't have to worry about what people thought of her when she was traveling alone or staying in a hotel alone. And she liked it. She liked the independence, and she didn't want to give it up. And she had no real reason to. She wasn't trying to fit into a permanent society or a place where she would, you know, be found out. She traveled, moved on, and it worked for her. It was a way to avoid what she saw as the limited choices to single women at the time.
And then we land at the most astonishing part of the book. By 1861, a person who isn't a citizen of the United States has been determined, partly because of her religious views, never to harm another individual, and is not a man, has enlisted in the United States Army shortly after the fall of Fort Sumter. What happened? How did that occur?
That's right. Well, she herself gave several different reasons throughout her life for why she did it, but it seems to be a combination of factors. She found herself in Flint, Michigan. She had put down a little bit of some roots there. She'd been there for a while, and she had joined a church, and many of the young men she knew were joining up, and she went to watch them ride off when their regiment was called, and it moved her, and she felt that she didn't want to stand around and be on the sidelines. But what she really wanted to do was to nurse. Mm-hmm. But at the time, as you know, there were no female nurses. That would change pretty quickly. But at the time, there weren't. And she felt that the way that she could go and help, she didn't want to be somebody just sewing bandages or socks mm-hmm. at home. So she concluded that the best way she could help was to actually go. And the best way she could do that was to pretend to be a man. I mean, she'd been getting away with it for 3 years, and it seemed like a natural thing for her to do. So it does, when you put it that way, it does seem a little odd that that was her choice. But she wanted to help. I also suspect that she wanted to continue this sense of community that she had found. She'd been isolated for so long. And the idea of, if you really think about what it would be like to live as an alias without being able to reveal your own identity, it was very isolating. And she didn't have any, you know, deep friends or family she could confide in. So this was a chance, I think, to continue her friendships with these men that she had gotten to know in Flint.
Because, well, at least initially in the war, they went as a group, right, from the same towns, from the same communities, people that they knew.
Right. The regiments were like families in a lot of ways, and particularly from these rural areas where, they, you know, a town would field a company, and that company would be all made up of people who'd known each other for years, and it was like a family, and probably the closest thing that she felt to a family since she left home.
Well, the obvious question, how did Frank pass the physical?
Well, she was lucky because at the time that she enlisted, the physicals were not very rigorously enforced. It was basically a matter of lining them up. And if somebody was missing a limb or coughing up blood, they would say, you know, unfit. But otherwise, it was pretty easy at that point to get in. It changed once they started realizing that there were a fair number of women that were trying to get into the ranks for a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. Some were doing it because they wanted to stay with lovers. Some were trying to get away from them. Some were trying to stay with their brothers, or some wanted to earn money. But they finally realized after a while that this was happening. But at the time that Emma enlisted, it was just completely unheard of. So the physicals were pretty easy right when she joined up. So she didn't have to remove any clothes. They just kind of lined them up and tapped them on the shoulders and looked at them. She was fairly tall for a woman of her mm-hmm. age. She was slender. She had been, as I said, passing as a man for 3 years, so she had the confidence to pull this off. A lot of women were discovered early on because they didn't have the experience that she had, and they would give themselves away by the way they coughed or the way they put on their clothes or the way they, you know, shrieked if something hit them on the head or something. So there was always some mannerism, but she had been working on this for a while, and she was a very good actress, and she pulled it off.
Did she ever arouse suspicion among her fellow soldiers? I had the small hands, no beard. There were clues.
There were clues. Fortunately, not until the very end is there any evidence that anyone in her regiment suspected, other than the one man that she mm-hmm. ultimately confided in. She was teased about her small feet and about her smooth cheeks, but she was able to laugh with them. And if anything, they must have suspected that she was an underaged boy. And there were many of those who were trying to serve their countries, and they were generally accepted as long as they could pull their own weight. And mm-hmm. the fact that she kind of laughed along with the men when they were teasing her, if there was any suspicion, it never went anywhere.
Well, she had a number of jobs during the war. Nurse, of course,
yes.
Mail courier, which apparently gave her quite a bit of freedom
right.
of movement, and possibly, and that's what we need to talk about a little bit, spy. Can you tell us a bit about some of her assignments and if indeed she was a spy for the Union Army?
Well, she did. As you said, she started out as a nurse, a male nurse. She volunteered for that. But she basically fell in love with one of the men in her regiment, and she confessed to him that she was in love with him. He was also a nurse. And when that didn't turn out quite the way she wanted it at first, she decided she needed to do something else. So she volunteered to be a mail carrier. And as you've mentioned, that gave her an enormous amount of freedom. She wrote a book right after the war in mm-hmm. which she claimed that during the time she served as a mail carrier, she went behind enemy lines on several occasions. And whether or not those claims are true has been something that has been a mystery, really, ever since she wrote them. And some historians accept it as absolute fact, and others have suggested it's simply too ludicrous to be believed. But my research has revealed to me, at least, that there are a few clues that suggest that, in fact, she probably did go behind enemy lines on at least several occasions. She may not have produced the kind of actionable intelligence that she claimed, mm-hmm. and some of her claims may have been embellished. In fact, most certainly were embellished. But there is some evidence, particularly in the journal of this man, Jerome Robbins, to whom she confided her true identity, about having been outside the picket lines. He writes about her having been outside the picket lines in a way that suggested it was a common occurrence. And the picket line is what divides the two sides. Mm-hmm. And there's really no reason to be on the other side of the picket line unless you are there to gather intelligence. There really wouldn't be any other reason. So I would say that my conclusion is that there was just enough evidence. And there was also later a book published about her service, about the Michigan Regiment's service, that mentions Frank Thompson as having been a spy. So there's a little bit of evidence to suggest that it was true.
And she
I'm inclined to believe her.
She claimed further to have continued her ability with disguises, right?
Yeah.
She worked as a spy, sometimes going as a slave?
Right. Her first foray, she claimed that she darkened her skin with silver nitrate and slipped behind enemy lines at Yorktown and infiltrated the Yorktown fort there, and was disguised as a male slave. And then the second time, she claims that she went behind enemy lines dressed as an Irish peddler woman, that she would have been a woman pretending to be a man, pretending to be a woman. We do know that Emma Thompson was able to live as a man for 5 years without being detected. So she obviously had a way with disguises, and mm-hmm. she had a way with accents. She was a real actress. And so it is, in my mind, quite possible that she pulled off these disguises. And she obviously was self-motivated and she was risk-taking. And I think it's entirely possible that she did these things.
Mm-hmm. And yet, despite her courage, her integrity, her obvious commitment to the Union cause, Frank became a deserter. What happened?
She did. She was 19 when the war started. She had been sheltered from the world of single men. I think she was a little overwhelmed, first by this one man, Jerome Robbins, and then when he went away for a while, she seems to have developed another relationship with a man named James Reed. And her desertion coincides with James Reed's leaving the army to go be with his wife. He was married. And she later said that she left the army because she was sick and she feared detection. And that was her official story years later when she went back to try and get her soldier's pension. But the record suggests also that in her diaries and also in Jerome Robbins' journals that she was in a very emotional state right before she left, and that it may have been a broken heart or disappointment in romance that caused her to take off. But she did take off, and her comrades had no idea where she went, although there's one entry in a soldier's diary that says that right after she left, that they had just discovered that their mail carrier was in fact a female, and they'd gotten a big laugh out of it. So she may have compromised her disguise right before she left, and it may have been in connection with her relationship with James Reed. That seems to be what the record suggests. So it's a mystery, but she did leave the army, and they didn't know what had happened to her until she came back to her regimental reunion 20 years later, now a middle-aged matron because she resumed her female identity, got married, had children, came back to her regimental reunion and said, "Hey, guys, it's me, Frank." And surprisingly enough, they really rallied around her. And they'd all been curious over the last 20 years what had happened to their small mail carrier. And they embraced her and they helped her get what ultimately became the only soldier's pension awarded to a female for combat duty during the Civil War.
We have time for one final question. Was Frank a feminist, as we understand that term today?
That's an interesting question. I would say she would probably not embrace that label, but she certainly embraced the concept of charting your own destiny and not accepting the limitations that society sets for anyone. And she didn't enter the political fray as some women were beginning to at the time, but she lived her own life according to how she saw fit. And I think that makes her a feminist in my view.
Emma Edmonds, Private Frank Thompson, defied social convention and family bonds to create an identity that would allow her to be fully part of some of the most important events of her time. It was an opportunity that she relished and never regretted taking. We've been talking to Laura Leedy Gansler, author of The Mysterious Private Thompson, The Double Life of Sarah Emma Edmonds, Civil War Soldier. Thank you, Laura.
Thank you.
This is Talking History.
So much has been written on the Civil War that it's hard to imagine a topic that has not been thoroughly exhausted. Much the same can be said of Civil War materials available on the web. If there is any area still wanting, it may be the role that women played in the war, especially those who fought in the war, like Sarah Edmondson, about whom you just heard. Well, Fiona Beattie has investigated the matter and has a recommendation for you.
I may be compelled to face danger, but never fear it. And while our soldiers can stand and fight, I can stand and feed and nurse them. So said Clara Barton, a nurse in the American Civil War and founder of the American Red Cross. And as we've just heard, women played diverse roles in that war. And for those interested in finding out more, Middle Tennessee State University has online resources meriting further investigation. Sections include bibliographical sources, primary sources, archives and digital collections, and links to Duke University's Women and the Civil War, manuscript sources in the Special Collections and the Historical Society of Pennsylvania's Guide to Women During the Civil War. In the primary sources section, searchers will find Ginny Daly's compilation of Civil War women primary sources on the internet. Here are links to diaries, letters, and documents, including a diary written by Alice Williamson, a teenage rebel girl living in Gallatin, Tennessee, and links to the Valley of the Shadow Project, a rich online archive comparing two Civil War communities, one northern and the other southern. And for those curious to learn a little more about women disguised as male soldiers and the women who elect to reenact such roles, click on Women Soldiers Reenactors and follow the link to Civil War, the site dedicated to the approximately 500 to 1,000 women soldiers who fought disguised as men on both sides, has interesting but not extensive information, as such information is scarce. To find out more, point your browser to www.mtsu.edu and follow the links.
I have a neighbor, one of those not very hard to find, who'd know without debate and never change their mind. I asked him what of women's rights. He said in tone severe, "My mind on that is all made up. Keep woman in her sphere." I saw a man in.
And finally, as promised, Harvey K. concludes this week's show by providing some history by which we may better understand the failure of government to respond promptly to the disaster wrought by Hurricane Katrina on America's Gulf Coast. He does so by recalling the words and vision of Thomas Paine. K. is the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Social Change and Development at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America.
Eager to reconnect with the spirit of 1776, Americans have turned biographies of Washington, Adams, Franklin, and Hamilton into bestsellers. We celebrate the founders and marvel at their battlefield heroics, literary talents, and political wisdom. However, as the failure of local, state, and federal governments to respond promptly to the disaster on the Gulf Coast all too tragically revealed, we've ignored the key point of the story, that the American Revolution was fought to create a nation radically different than those of the old world. Ironically, even as we've been enthusiastically reading about the founders, we have been foolishly turning away from their greatest legacy, the idea that government should be dedicated to the pursuit of the public good, not the good of selected families. While cutting taxes for the rich and welfare provisions for the neediest, we have allowed our material inequalities to intensify, our social divisions to widen, our industrial foundations to weaken, our infrastructures to decay, and our capacities to respond to threats to our national security and freedom to decline. When Americans declared their independence, they firmly believed they were acting in behalf of future generations and humanity at large. Thomas Paine wrote, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again, and the cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind." Paine proclaimed that Americans possess the opportunity and duty to create a great nation by constituting a new kind of government, a democratic republic dedicated to advancing the res publica, the public good. The new nation was to serve as a model to the world, an asylum for mankind, and in the fullness of time, an ally in the global struggle for freedom. As our founding documents set forth, America would be a nation based on the proposition that all men are created equal, a country in which we, the people, form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. The crisis of our time did not begin with the controversial election of 2000. Hardly. But it did take a dramatic change for the worse when President George Bush undertook a costly invasion of Iraq, doing so not only based on false or mistaken pretenses, but also without having properly planned for the expected occupation. Compounding the problems, his administration denied requests for funds to properly protect our shores against both terrorists and floodwaters. When in the revolution's darkest days, Paine wrote, "These are the times that try men's souls." He was neither lamenting nor complaining about the dangers he and his compatriots faced. He was issuing a call to action. In that spirit, as well as to honor the founders, those who died on 9/11, in combat in Afghanistan and Iraq and on the Gulf Coast, let us make this the time that we redeem the most profound meaning of the American Revolution. Let us reaffirm the nation's extraordinary purpose and promise. Let us renew our commitment to cultivating the public good and extending and deepening freedom, equality, and democracy. Indeed, let us be guided not simply by an urgent sense of crisis, but also by Thomas Paine's belief that the sun never shined on a cause of greater worth.
You've been listening to Harvey Kay, Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Social Change and Development at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, and the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, published by Hill and Wang. Kay's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OAH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oah.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.